This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Jake Phelps was a well-known civil rights activist from an early age. He doesn't mind talking about the struggle, but he does have one complaint. Many people who hear his story assume he's black or not a Southerner. Jake is white. He was born and raised in Winston-Salem in the 1930s, and his call to the civil rights movement was reinforced by his many years of witnessing firsthand the impact of segregation in his hometown. When he was 19, he went to work for the Greensboro Record, and during his college years, he worked for the Durham Herald, covered the civil rights movement, even when his editors told him to stop. Jake Phelps now lives in the Triangle, and he joins us in the studio today. Jake, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Frank.
You became conscious of segregation and its impact as a young white man in Winston-Salem. How did you notice?
It goes all the way back to being preschool. I was only five when we had a home right on the city limits, western city limits. And Mr. Miller owned all of the land from that city limits west. And when he died, he left all of his huge farm to the city for a recreational park. And when they started to build the park, my little brother and I would go down to the park and we would just go right through the woods and where they were starting to build. And we would help this man, and we had asked him his name, and he told us Arthur, and then we started calling him Mr. Arthur, and we would go back home and tell my mother that we had been helping Mr. Arthur build the park. And my mother, after a few weeks, wanted to come down and see what we did down, spend our days doing down there. And we introduced her to Mr. Arthur. And when she saw that he was black, she told us very openly in front of him, "You don't call colored people Mr. and Ms. You call a man uncle and a woman Annie. Annie," is the way we said it. So
you're told now you're being indoctrinated, inculcated.
Right.
This is how it goes.
The Southern culture, and my mother was very sweet and very religious, and she told me that they don't like to be called Mr. and Miss, and that we should learn to be nice to them in the way that they're used to. And when she left, I just asked Mr. Arthur, about what she had just said, and I wanted to know why they didn't like it. And he said, "Well, I don't know what she thinks, but I liked it when you called me Mr. Arthur."
Did you decide at that point that you would continue
to call
him?
Yes, and I asked my brother, I said, "Why can't we just call him Mr. Arthur? And then we won't have to say anything at home about it."
Eventually, your parents did catch on. You did have to confront this at home.
I got very interested in a lot of the things that they told me as they started telling me about black people. And how do you know that? And I met and got to know and like very much the janitor at our church, at Ardmore Moravian Church. And he had talked to me about how he felt about not being able to go to his church.
And he's talking about that. Are you asking questions?
Yeah.
Why can't you come here?
And very curious. And we lived through that stretch of woods, long farm, and very close to Hainstown. And we had gotten to know black kids over there as we got older. And I asked them about how they felt about going to school separately from white people.
By now the question is in the papers. It's on the lips of everybody at church.
Right.
It's coming up in
that's
school.
Right.
Becoming a question, you now have this repository, this collection of stories, your own personal accounts now that are conflicting with what you're being told in school. Are you asking then white folks?
Oh, yes.
Are you telling them what you're finding? And
yes. Oh, yes. And trying to tell my parents. And my father had been the central elder of Ardmore Moravian Church, and I thought that I could lean on him and get him to admit our janitor into the Moravian Church. And he said, oh, no, they have, the black people have, the colored folks have Happy Hill out east of Winston-Salem with the Moravian Church there, but it's separate, you know. And I talked to, anyway, when the man did apply, my father was the one that stood in the door, you know, and said, you know, we don't do that. And I got, you know, very concerned then about why a Christian congregation would shut this man out and refuse to let him come into the church.
Was there a confrontation with your father over this?
Between my father and me, but not between my father and the janitor. He, of course, learned. I mean, he just took the orders from my father that this was not even considered, you know. And
What did that do to the relationship between you and your father?
It started the rumblings that just kept on growing and went until he died. And when in 1973, when he died, he was still maintaining that to my relatives, you know, that Jake's still going through that phase, and I don't know when he's going to grow out of it, you know. And I had been involved in all of these civil rights things. There were two great things that happened to me during my teenage years. That one was when I was a senior at Reynolds High School in Winston-Salem, and I was elected president of the student body, and I went to Fayetteville for the state student council convention. It was made up of all of the presidents of all of the student bodies, the white student bodies in the state. And I went to that, when I walked up to register, the lady, the volunteer at the desk said, well, you're in luck. You're going to be staying with Mr. Terry Sanford. Have you heard of him? And I said, no, ma'am, we haven't heard of him. And she said, well, he's the president of the state Young Democrats, and he's rumored to plan to run for governor one day, and there are a lot of people here who hope that he does get elected. And so I went over to their house on that Friday and met him and stayed up very late that night talking to him. And he was very curious about, particularly with the position that I had and the conversations that I was having with the people, other delegates there, you know, that I was president of a student body as large as Reynolds High, and that I was also, you know, all talking about...
You're opposed to segregation, as was Terry Sanford. Here was somebody in the vanguard in the South, certainly one of the most progressive politicians of his time down here in the South, wrestling with how he was going to manage this in a state that wasn't quite ready, but he knew it had to go. So he meets you, and there's some hope. But let me take you back a step. I want to ask the same question I'm guessing Terry Sanford asked you, which is, how did you get elected president with those views? Did everybody know? Were you open about this in high school?
Absolutely open. What we did was there were a number of things that we tried. And as I would talk to them and find anybody who felt like I did, even the people who, that didn't agree with me about desegregation, were still very friendly and very, you know, we were active in so many things and music
But you weren't an outcast. You were able to have, and as a young man, some of us are impatient in those days, but did you find yourself getting impatient, grabbing people by the lapels, saying, listen,
no. No, I didn't. I just found that I was able to make progress, and I really, and then of course we had other things that happened. We had a teacher at Reynolds High School, Mr. Barnett, who was taught the required history course, and he was famous for saying this to a group of high school seniors at Reynolds in my opinion, Abraham Lincoln was both figuratively and literally a bastard. And we all knew what his feelings were about the Civil War immediately. And I for my term paper, which was one of the major requirements for graduation, I wrote a very celebratory kind of a biography of John Brown.
And did you let Mr. Barnett read that?
I had to. And of course, we had words about it, and he was very disappointed and wouldn't give me credit for it.
Oh, well, more about that and that fortuitous meeting with Terry Sanford when my conversation with Jake Phelps, a North Carolina native and civil rights activist, continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today I'm talking with Jake Phelps, a civil rights activist and North Carolina native. His story goes way back, and what is unique about it is, for a man born in the 1930s, he is a white man and a native Southerner who took an active role in the civil rights movement, and that was somewhat unusual for that time and down here in this place. Jake, you talked about that meeting in high school when you were the senior in high school, president of the student body, and met Terry Sanford. And he was wondering how you managed to be elected because your politics and your anti-segregation views were well known. What went on in that conversation? What was he asking you?
He wanted to know how I thought we could work out the whole transfer of prominence to our argument. And there were two people I mentioned that I met when I was a teenager. The second one was Floyd McKissick. I had come down to Chapel Hill for 1 year, and I was working at 3 hours a day at Lenore Hall in the cafeteria. There was a tall black man who would come at lunch and would sit down by himself, and I asked if I could take my lunch half hour with when he came in. Floyd McKissick was a student at NC Central and law school, and when I got to know him, it turned out that we had a great deal in common, and I went to Greensboro after I had to drop out at Chapel Hill and to be the reporter there. And of course, one of the main things they wanted me to talk about was the students in schools in 54, that end of that first year in Chapel Hill. And as you know, on May 17th of 54, then the
Brown decision to desegregate the schools.
Exactly right. Yeah. So they
wanted you to get the reaction to that,
yes,
I assume.
I had also drawn by lot, I guess, the luck of having to interview Senator Pearsall, and who had drafted the Pearsall plan to keep the schools segregated, and I wrote some things that just like Mr. Barnett did me with the John Brown paper. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't publish, they wouldn't give me credit for it.
But so that you're saying these stories or those parts of the stories never even got in, and this is the Greensboro News and Record, right? At
the time. The Record, the afternoon paper, more conservative of the two papers. And I talked to Terry about how this was, how the whole South was taking this, and and he was really concerned. And I was so thankful that I could quote Terry Sanford to my father, and because his name kept coming up, you know, and more prominently in state news. I just was able to connect Floyd's feelings with Terry's and lay these out to my father, which was a very interesting experiment. And
was it persuasive to your father?
He would stop and interject, you know, if I would throw in something, some biblical reference or something like that, you know, you'd say, well, now, you've got a point there, I'll admit.
Very good. And of course, Floyd McKissick, a much more outspoken civil rights leader.
Absolutely.
Unique in a sense for a Southern black man in that time.
Absolutely.
To be as outspoken.
You're exactly right. And he had had suits in court already for his own education and for his children's education to bring suit against the state.
What was it like? I want to ask you about Terry Sanford, though. This, for you, to meet a man having, you know, argued, struggled, convinced, whatever it was you were doing in the halls of school, these conversations that you were having, to finally meet a white man with political potential who actually agreed with you, who you didn't have to persuade.
You're right. And a man that my father had to admit was regular.
Can't find anything wrong with him.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And it was just a great reassurance. And I liked him a great deal. Terry was an instantly likable and challenging and I appreciated the fact that he listened with respect to what I was saying. I mean, I hadn't been able to find white adults who would, you know, that.
Well, and apparently, and a keen politician as well, the great story that I think everybody tells that maybe bears retelling at this moment, where he's at a fundraiser, he's out in the country somewhere. He's one of the good old boys comes up to him and says, "Now, Terry, I just have to ask you, where do you stand on integration?"
That's right.
He said, "Well,
you know where I stand.
Very
with that little wink.
I want to know more about your journalism career, because you ended up or did work for a while for the Durham Herald.
Uh-huh. When I got discharged in Europe, a number of friends from the Army were stationed in Frankfurt, and they knew that I was an aspiring playwright, too, and they told me that they had just gotten an authorization for an American playhouse in Frankfurt that the 6th Army Corps would run, and that they could hire a manager for it, and they asked me to come back to Frankfurt and to Germany and to manage this playhouse. And I went back and was writing a play already on John Brown.
And take that, Mr. Barnett.
Right. No, I did. I've got a thing about that. But managed the playhouse, and we went through two productions, and it was just wonderful fun.
We should point this out. Now, this is, again, what period of time now? We're talking about the...
1958-59.
So 1958-1959, the Army. It is now integrated. We've got a lot of Southerners. We've got people from all over the country. You're doing a play about John Brown. And for many Southerners, this is the only integrated experience they're going to have, right? Because when they come home, it's not going to be the same as it was in the Army. And now there's this drama that they're watching in Frankfurt that you put on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting to think about these cultural and,
absolutely,
in a sense, political currents coming together for people who are thrown overseas, then come back and have to negotiate this very new terrain in the early 60s.
Yeah.
You actually received accolades for that and a pretty good review.
Yes, that was from over at Chapel Hill. I went into playwriting while it was in Chapel Hill, and they produced three plays of mine, and the first one was John Brown. And when it got the good reviews, I mailed Mr. Barnett a copy of
Hey, your student done good. Look over here.
That's right. And that was delightful to do.
Any response from Mr. Barnett?
No, none at all.
Guessing not. So you're playwriting. You're drawn to literature. You're drawn to writing.
Yeah, and I wrote a play based on Floyd and Evelyn McKissick, too, except that the man in the play was Monroe Worthy, who was a minister and not a lawyer. But and it was what they had to go through with Joycelyn, their daughter, when Floyd was so proud of her and so determined that she was going to be a great example and a leader in the desegregation of schools in the South. And her mother was scared to death. Evelyn was completely frozen with fright over it. And I talked to both of them and cried with them. And that movement was an incredible thing to go through and with families.
And particularly coming back to this as outspoken and as confrontational as Floyd McKissick could
was.
Be. Yeah.
I mean, absolutely.
Those young men come to no good if you're a mother of a young man like that.
So right.
So you can understand her worry, but certainly down here there was resistance, and yet your plays are seeing the light of day. How do you explain
yes,
that?
Yes, the playmakers at Chapel Hill took them and once they had been produced over the air, we turned that around after we had produced it at Central at the college. Then the thing was that we used it to desegregate allied arts. It was the predecessor of the Durham Arts Council, and we had a great deal of effect on the discussions in Durham of people on the school boards
And yet when you write for the papers, when we're talking about straight-up journalism,
right,
you're getting a lot more resistance there.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I definitely wanted to felt that the Herald should want to go to Washington for the March on Washington, August 27th of 63.
You're a reporter for the Herald at this time.
Right. And they would not let me do that. But I took vacation and went up there and at my own expense and everything. And then Floyd took me right into the Jefferson Hotel at night and before. And I had met Martin King here. And then I was able to just be involved in that critical period and that critical situation. And John Lewis, God bless that man,
a congressman from Georgia, but at the time he was one of the members of SNCC and one of the early sit-in members. Yeah.
That's exactly right. Anyway, we were there when John wanted to make a confrontational speech and Martin was just and wouldn't let him. And thank God, he's glad too, I'm sure now, that he lost that argument.
Well, let me stop you there because now you're in on some of the most amazing conversations of the civil rights movement. You're there, you're at the hotel, and you're a reporter, even albeit on vacation. Now you've got some great stuff. How happy is the Herald to see your stuff?
Oh, no, not at all. When Floyd had Malcolm X down here, and I had to take vacation again to cover him, and I spent two full days with him, that I was really impressed and wrote some things about him and about the whole movement and what an influence I was able to find in Durham and that he was having already. They were very upset over that and talked to me about leaving, about leaving the paper. And
eventually they did have that final conversation about leaving with you,
right,
didn't they?
Right, but that wasn't until 66. And so the funny thing is that from 60 to 66, I was a reporter for the paper and covering all of these things that Floyd wanted me to cover and wanted me to
Were you able to sneak any of it in?
Could
you
get it? Uh-huh.
So there was some coverage.
Yes, sir.
Because you were pushing back, yeah.
We would do things like I would go in and tell them after leaving a meeting at Central at the college and tell them there's going to be a march from the campus at the college to City Hall at 5 o'clock today. And they would say, absolutely not, and you're not going around it, and you're going to be here in the office. And I would call Bob Satan. He was an instructor in philosophy over at Chapel Hill and had a close friend at AP in Raleigh. And I would call him and say, they said no. So, if you'll call him and tell him, I would watch the copy boy after people had been yelling at me. You're a reporter for this paper. You're not press agent for the Corps.
It's only the biggest story in the South, but they're calling you a press agent because you want to tell the story, right?
I kept telling them, could you imagine, 20 and 30 years from now when these graduate students are trying to write dissertations about about the most important sociological upheaval in the South in our lifetimes, and they find that they can get more by reading the Washington Post than they can by coming here, because they can't find anything in this paper about it.
That's
but
great.
They can find from the Post and the Times.
And of course, the reason you would call the AP then is they would call, and because it's a co-op, they would then ask you be sent out for the AP.
Right. I would watch the copy boy come in and take the copy over to the telegraph desk and then see him come by and throw the city editor this one thing, and I would know what it was. And, of course, then the city editor would say, God, you would say, and then he would hand me the thing, and he would say, give me 20 inches on this, and I would say, well, I need to go down there and meet him.
Mind if I actually show up and report?
Right.
Ultimately, though, it did cost you your job.
Oh, yeah. It was a major blow up.
And it cost you your comfort. You were now, by this time, a target of some violent activity yourself.
Yeah. I got more and more harassing phone calls, I never took that seriously until 68, 69.
But there were some serious things that were happening. I mean, you started out losing about a mailbox a week, right?
Oh, yeah. It that would just happen over and over. And we lived way up on this knoll, way off the road, and we'd hear this blam, and I would just say, oh, Lord, and I've got to do all of this other stuff, over at Chapel Hill or whatever. And then we'd hear the boys, shuffling across the floor in the living room, coming into the bedroom.
But they're blowing up your mailboxes.
Yeah.
They're blowing them up.
Yeah, they would just blow them up. And it was just, and what they would tell me on the phone, is that we ain't bloodthirsty. We ain't going to hurt your boys, and we ain't even going to hurt your dogs. And they would tell me, that they weren't. And then all of a sudden, in 68, Peggy, I had built a little potting shed out of our entry hall, and Peggy had gone to Penland School of Crafts, and then she was potting there and tried to smoke a cigarette and dropped it in the sofa, and she called up to Duke and she told me, that the house was on, I mean, screamed that the house was on fire, And we were able to get the fire department out there, and they put it out. Then the calls that we got after that, and all of a sudden they were saying, well, we almost got you this time. We almost got your house. And I would tell them, I don't know why it rattled me so bad, but I would just tell them, you're crazy. You don't even understand that my wife started that fire, and that was an accident, and I got riled up about it too. That it was just to leave it alone, because I was trying to convince Peggy and the boys that nothing really bad was going to happen. That these people, they wouldn't call in the middle of the night all the time if they had guts enough to stand up for what they wanted to force anyway. And then on the day before Thanksgiving, then that son that you met just now, it called me and told me that they had just gotten out of the Carolina Friends School, early that day, because it was the day before Thanksgiving, and that they had gotten home and that the house was all smoked up and everything. And so we called the fire department, and he did, and got them out and stopped that one.
But that was the second fire.
So that was the second fire. And there was a real, they called bragging about it. And there was a bloodthirstiness in their tone all of a sudden that they were going to really get it, you know, that they were going to get that house. And their attitude just changed, and I really couldn't tell what was going on. And the thing was that I realized that what had changed was that Richard Nixon had been elected as president of the United States.
Do you think that sent a signal of some kind?
Both Margaret and I feel like, you know, that there was just a change, a real, you know, a significant change in a general attitude and what they thought they could get by with and what they thought their rights were.
On the State of Things today, talking with Jake Phelps, North Carolina native and civil rights activist. Next, we're going to hear about Jake's contribution to Duke University. On the State of Things, please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Jake Phelps, civil rights activist, North Carolina native. Jake also helped to develop the Bryan Center on the campus of Duke University. And Jake, of course, you talked earlier about your friendship with Terry Sanford, North Carolina politician, governor, and, of course, president of Duke at some point. This relationship then came back, and he remembered you.
Oh, yes, and I was so relieved. There had been discussion after Doug Knight had resigned as president of Duke that what the trustees wanted was a retired general to, you know. One of the first things that he wanted to know was how had the dissatisfaction with Doug Knight rumbled to the surface, and then that what had happened. And I was very close then to Mark Pinsky, who was the radical in residence at Duke, and he had a column in the Chronicle that he called the readable radical, and he just connected me with everybody there and all of the students who were, introduced me as an old lefty.
what year is this?
This was 69.
So what did Terry have in mind for you? Did he have a position? Was it you were just a consultant and advisor first?
Shaw University was going to have, it was after Jim Cheek had been named president of Howard University in Washington, and the Shaw trustees named his brother, King Cheek, as the new president. And King was supposed to come in and start a major fundraising drive. And they asked Terry Sanford to become the head of it. And so I wrote his speech. And when I went by to see him about it, you know, he said, "I changed one thing." And I said, "Well, that's great. What was that?" And he said, "That period at the end of your last sentence." He said, "I made an exclamation point."
Wow. So he likes your writing. You're somebody he can trust. He's now president of Duke at this transitional time. And what were you doing? Because eventually, then, he decides that we need to upgrade the student center.
Yes. And it had been something that Duke had wanted to do since the 30s. And they had to put it off because of World War II. Then they had to put it off because of the veterans flooding the campus, and they couldn't take that on.
But did he come right out and ask you, "Look, Jake, we need a student union, and you're the guy. But you're a writer."
I know, but he wanted, you know, he wanted me to try it, and there was a selection committee, and I interviewed with them and told them what I thought we ought to do for a university center, and they asked me if I would take it on, and I asked Terry if, you know, I'm not going to be able to write anything else for you or anything else, any other jobs, you know, and he said that this one is the one that I want you to do, and so I took that on.
Well, weird. Let me ask you about that, because that actually became a hot issue in the late 60s. Student unions, how students would gather. I mean, I'm from Buffalo, New York. They built a brand new campus in the late 60s and early 70s, and they deliberately kept students from ever congregating anywhere. There's a lot of open space between the buildings, and there's no real place that students could congregate, and that was very deliberate architecture. You weren't going to make that mistake again.
That's right.
What were your thoughts about what a student union should be?
I thought it should be a wide open place, and we'd ask the architects to make it a place, to design a place that where your adrenaline level would jump when you walked in, you know, and that there would be enough that was visually and otherwise exciting enough to get you interested, you know, in doing something and to have it all available and very visible. And they did a wonderful job.
Beautiful space there. You're right. I mean, it's all open. It's spiral staircases and theater space.
Right, right. And that happens to be just a funny story. John Feinstein was the sports editor at that time of the Chronicle. And when he was, and I was very close with the Chronicle, and when John needed a summer internship, and applied for the one at the Washington Post, which was a prestigious thing for one senior in the whole country. And so they gave it to him, and John came by the morning after and wanted to know if he could take me to lunch. And I said, no, I've got to go get these fish for my new lake. And I said, but if you want to go with me over there, you know, we can have that time. And he did, and he helped me stock the thing.
Well, now, which lake is this?
At my house.
At your house, okay. So now you're with John Stock in the lake.
When we were going back up to the house afterward, and I was thanking him, and he said, "Well, let me tell you, my father said if he could ever do anything for you, and I felt the same way. I'm just so glad to be able to help you with this thing today." And he said, "My father wants you to let him know if there's and I was used to that, frankly, already from students' parents.
This is John Feinstein, who has gone on to have quite a career in sports writing and Sports Illustrated. He's on television and radio all the time. That John Feinstein, right?
Right, exactly. Yes. I said, by the way, what did your father do? And he said, oh, I thought you knew. He's the executive director of the Kennedy Center in Washington. And I said, Martin Feinstein is your father? And he said, yes. And I said, good Lord, could he help me? And so John just went back up to the house and called his father. And in a minute, I was talking to Martin Feinstein, and he said, well, you must have preliminary discussions and plans and things. And he said, can you just throw those in the back of your car and drive up here? And he said, and I'll have the whole staff, you know, just mark off the day.
I understand. I mean, this really amounts to, by the time they were finished, really millions or at least $1 million worth of free consulting.
More. Yeah, I'm sure that we couldn't have bought it for anything. And especially not with the comfort and the accommodations and the enthusiasm of that, all of that. Alex Moores was the manager of the theaters, and he came down, you know, at his own expense, you know, and they got really interested in the thing, and they were telling me all of these. And so I had called this big meeting of everybody from the planning committee and the building committee and the architects and all of the users of the theaters, you know, and when they said, where did you learn all this? And I said, I just make a good parrot.
So you read the plan. Now, it's one thing to have these fabulous plans, and of course, to get them for free is even more spectacular. But now you got to build a building.
Yep. Yep. But then another alumnus, Diane Britz Lodi, she had been the chair of the Performing Arts Committee in the union, and she came down to spend the weekend and introduced me to her fiancé. And while they were staying with us, she told me that she had wondered if anybody had ever mentioned Joe Bryan to me. And I said, I know the name. And I just know that he helped when I was in graduate school in radio, television, motion pictures at Chapel Hill. And he was a great angel for us. And she said, he's an angel for more than that. And she said, and I think you ought to talk to him. And Monday morning, I got up and just typed out this note to Terry and went by his office and dropped it off on the way to my office. When I walked into my office, the secretary said, the president wants you to turn around and run back over there as fast as you can. And when I walked in, the lobby at Allen Building was full of people waiting for him. And his secretary said, come in here quick. And I went running. And he just said, why in the hell didn't I think of Joe Bryan? He said, you guys are going to fall in love with each other. I can predict it. And he was right. And Joe was going through this awful thing with his wife with Alzheimer's. And so when we got to know each other, and he was just so generous and so smart. And I loved the fact that he had made his money the way he did.
Which is how?
In World War II, he knew that television was going to become he had already established the Jefferson Standard Broadcasting Company, and he knew that the only way that the government was going to be able to handle the huge flood of applications that they were going to get as soon as the thing was over was to depend on the network of licenses for AM stations and FM stations, and that television was going to have to follow. And he bought up all of these licenses while nobody was looking. Mm-hmm. He just offered it, let people set their prices, and he bought them up.
So then and you got along very well. He liked the plans.
Oh yeah.
And how did that turn out?
Yeah, well, we just not only did he like the plans for that, but he got very interested in the medical center and began coming down regularly while we were under construction with the Bryan Center, and he talked to Alan Roses, the man who was interested in that area of medicine, and ended up giving us $11 million for the Alzheimer's Center, and which is now into neuroscience, which my youngest son is now in Columbia University doing. And wow.
And of course, he provided most of the funding for the Bryan Center.
Exactly.
And what did that, how, what at that time, what would it cost to build that?
Oh, it was, in hard numbers, it was $16 million, but it actually went over $20 million. Yeah. But
and then you directed that Bryan Center for right. many, many years.
Yeah, that's right.
I want to ask you now, if you look back over your long career and going back to those earliest days in the civil rights movement, and to take a look at the headlines today as you look at the occupation movement, they're so different in many ways. There was a discrete legal objective, the end of segregation, the end of Jim Crow as the kind of object, the goal, back in those days. Now we're seeing an emphasis on economic injustice writ large, and people are talking about it out loud. That's the centerpiece of this movement. Is there a connection? Do you see this as kind of part of the genealogy that goes back to the civil rights movement you were such a part of?
Yes, I do, and I really feel that if Obama had taken advantage of the situation and guided it a great deal more deftly and sympathetically, that he could have had the same kind of role that Jack Kennedy had, and when we were putting the civil rights movement together.
What do you think is the central issue, or should be?
Oh, I think that economic justice and there just needs to be an awareness and right now that I really think that it's got to be strict regulations of banks and in fact, I'm not opposed at all to a temporary nationalization of banking until we can get it under control. And then we can move it back into the private sector. Nothing's going to change. Tim Geithner, I don't think, is going to ever bend on that.
Has that always been sort of at the foundation, do you think, of the civil rights movement? As I say, the focus, certainly back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, was segregation. But was that an issue that occurred to you? Did you see that as the foundation, economic justice as the foundation of what we call the civil rights movement back then.
Right. I don't know whether it was because of my age or not, but I felt from all the way back to 12 and 14 and 16 that we had to desegregate schools, that the South did not want to live with this smudge on its face. I am still very conscientiously and happily a Southerner, and I really want to see it live up to its potential, which it is now, and as a full-fledged citizen, you know. Mm-hmm. And I felt back then that I hope we can find what we're both in this conversation even struggling for, and to find a key, you know, like desegregation of schools became, and to kick off the civil rights movement.
Do you think the occupation movement can be effective? I mean, given the fact that there is not this discrete goal, a kind of end game that you can declare victory.
Well, I do think that it would have been a lot more likely if we could have declared a moratorium right now. We needed the moratorium for
people. You mean moratorium on occupation? No,
yes,
call it off for a while.
Just to take it out until out of circulation for right now, and then and promise to get it and articulated, and then to bring it back, and you know, with an understanding, and you know, a mass understanding of what we really wanted out of it, and I think that would have given us the breathing time, the discussion time, the organizational time that we could have used.
You know, but Jake, this does seem, it's interesting that you say that the we seems to be the issue here. Who's the we who would call the moratorium? And is this the, you know, painting the train rolling down the tracks? We're not going to stop at the station.
That's right. That's true. I think that the whole society would be happier and more successful, you know, more prosperous, and we could finally get some understanding. And I think that banks need to be threatened, and you know, now to push everybody off their pedestals and to get them moving, you know, toward a goal that everybody knows what the goal would be, and it would be equality, and you know, or stretch toward equality, and it would be, you know, a wonderful redistribution that would not be socialistic.
No, it wouldn't be government-sponsored at all. It means real autonomy over your own financial security.
That's right.
Which doesn't always happen in a corporate society.
Yes, sir. You're right.
Jake, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking
Thank
with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Jake Phelps, a North Carolina native involved in the civil rights movement, instrumental in desegregating churches and schools right here in the Triangle, helped with the creation of the Bryan Center at the Duke University campus, and was its director for many years. And that's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. Our program can be found on a website, stateofthings.org, and you can find a link to calendars of events, anything that we mentioned on the show. We're on Facebook as well. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.